Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, July 24th. Congressman Hakeem Jeffries of Brooklyn and Queens will join us in just a minute. Among other things, we'll get his reaction as a New York congressional colleague, as a human being, and as a man, to the verbal abuse that a Republican congressman from Florida reportedly heaped on Bronx and Queens Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on the Capitol steps in front of a reporter from the news organization The Hill. Congressman Ted Yoho called her an effing B, but he used the real words. The congresswoman reacted yesterday on the House floor.
He gave permission to use that language against his wife, his daughters, women in his community. And I am here to stand up to say that is not acceptable.
As for Congressman Yoho, he apologized, sort of, though denied he used the obscenities despite it being reported by The Hill. If you don't know The Hill, that's a news organization that's respected by both parties in Washington and tends to lean right in its editorials. And remember, he's a 65-year-old white guy who felt he had license to talk like that to a 30-year-old woman of color. He did offer kind of an apology.
Having been married for 45 years with two daughters, I'm very cognizant of my language.
But if that was an apology, I would hate to hear what your non-apologies sound like. AOC reacted to his reaction.
Having a daughter does not make a man decent. Having a wife does not make a decent man. Treating people with dignity and respect makes a decent man.
So there's that. At the same time as Democrats and Republicans are negotiating the next coronavirus relief bill, with the economic emergency caused by COVID-19 continuing for so many Americans. The temporary enhanced unemployment benefits expire next week, and the small business loans were only supposed to cover 2 months. What should happen next with them? With us now is Brooklyn and Queens Democratic Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, also a top aide to Nancy Pelosi in the House leadership as chairman of the House Democratic Caucus. Congressman, always a pleasure. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Great to be on.
You know, I never heard of Congressman Yoho before, from a district north of Orlando, and I gather he's already not running for re-election this year. What's your reaction to the incident in and of itself, and if it suggests anything more systemic?
Well, while you've never heard of Congressman Yoho, unfortunately, many of us have over the years, Brian, and so it was not necessarily unexpected that he would engage in such outrageous and outlandish conduct. Though this particular instance is particularly egregious for the reasons that you set forth. You know, Representative Ocasio-Cortez is, as I've stated publicly, an important part of the House Democratic Caucus. She's a talented and passionate public servant. And there's just no circumstance where the manner in which Congressman Yoho aggressively approached Representative Ocasio-Cortez is justified. And certainly no circumstance where that type of offensive language should ever be tolerated. His apology was inadequate. He needs to rethink it. He needs to publicly restate it. And he needs to show some genuine contrition and acknowledgement of the wrongdoing of his conduct.
I'm going to read for our listeners part of the original story written by reporter Mike Lillis in The Hill. Quote, Representative Ted Yoho, Republican from Florida, was coming down the steps on the east side of the Capitol on Monday, having just voted, when he approached Ocasio-Cortez, who was ascending into the building to cast a vote of her own. In a brief but heated exchange, which was overheard by a reporter, Yoho told Ocasio-Cortez she was, quote, disgusting for recently suggesting that poverty and unemployment are driving a spike in crime in New York City during the coronavirus pandemic. Quote, you are out of your freaking mind, Yoho told her. Ocasio-Cortez shot back, telling Yoho he was being rude, The two then parted ways. Ocasio-Cortez headed into the building, while Yoho, joined by Representative Roger Williams, Republican from Texas, began descending toward the House office buildings. A few steps down, Yoho offered a parting thought to no one in particular, quote, effing B, he said. But again, he used the full words that I can't say on the radio. So my question to you, Congressman, is what about Congressman Williams from Texas, who The Hill reports witnessed this, and Ocasio-Cortez says didn't rebuke Congressman Yoho for it? Is he apologizing for his passivity or acknowledging that Yoho said what The Hill reported?
I haven't seen any statement from Congressman Williams, but I think this speaks to a broader question of culture and intolerance that exists in far too many quarters throughout America. And what we have seen, particularly over the last 3.5 years, is that when such aggressive, inappropriate, offensive, outrageous, hateful language can emanate from the top leader in the land on a regular basis, then it does have an impact on people's behavior in the halls of Congress and throughout the communities in America. That's not to blame this particular outburst and outrage that occurred from Ted Yoho explicitly on President Trump, but there is a culture of intolerance that has taken hold in America, and he has fanned those flames repeatedly and intentionally. And that is one of the reasons why we think a change in direction on November 3rd is going to be merited, necessary, and will occur.
Because of Yoho's obscenities, you know, another part of what he said isn't being commented on very much. According to the story in The Hill, as I just read it, Yoho first told Ocasio-Cortez she was disgusting for suggesting that poverty and unemployment are driving the spike in crime in New York City during the coronavirus pandemic. And besides calling her disgusting for that, he added, "You are out of your freaking mind." So that's all extremely disrespectful too, despite it being words that we are allowed to say on the radio. But he called her those things for suggesting what? That poverty and unemployment might have anything to do with crime. Did you notice that part?
Yes, and that is a particularly striking part because that speaks to a broader mentality that exists, and you see it broadcast by certain news outlets and certain conservative media vehicles that feed into a narrative that President Trump is trying to project, which is to blame others, inspire fear, and try to run on this mindset of a law and order presidency when he's the one that's presiding over the chaos without looking at the deeper issues that plague our society. And one of the reasons why you have such unequal living conditions that occur. I think that Representative Ocasio-Cortez's point in terms of poverty and its correlation to violence is an empirically sound one in any part of the country. If you look at Appalachia, if you look at certain rural communities where you have elevated violence levels or have elevated levels of drug overdoses or illicit activity, so to speak, that often directly correlates with poverty and the lack of opportunity. Whether it's in the inner city, rural America, small town America, or all points in between.
Is the spike in shootings taking place in part in your district, in Brooklyn and Queens, and what do you think is causing it? Is there a mix of factors?
Well, there are definitely a mix of factors, and I think we all have to take a step back and allow for a deep dive into understanding why it has occurred. Prior to the more recent events surrounding the police reform movement, many of us, including public advocate Jamani Williams, publicly expressed concern about the likely increase in violence that we would see given the devastating conditions that were impacting, in particular, low-income communities of color, the absence of opportunity, and the potential deprivation and decrease in some of the things that had traditionally been available, whether that's around summer youth employment and or extracurricular and after-school and sports activities. And so We can, as a society, choose to invest in education and opportunity or in incarceration. The most efficient investment would be for us to invest in education and opportunity. That is not always what our society has done. And that goes all the way back decades. The Kerner Commission report made very clear that some of the conditions that you see within the inner city, and perhaps where you see elevated levels of violence in certain instances, can be directly tied to the lack of economic opportunity, to deprivation, to people living in desperate conditions. Now, I grew up in the New York City, Brian, as you know, in the late 80s and early 90s when I came of age, where you had 2,000-plus homicides that were taking place in the midst of the crack cocaine epidemic. We have come a long way in that regard. We don't want to go back. We just want to go forward. And so rather than cast blame, my view has been, let's figure out how law enforcement and the police and young people can all come together in the most productive, forward-looking way to ensure that we decrease and stop the violence and we elevate economic opportunity so that everyone can pursue the American dream.
Before we move on to coronavirus relief negotiations, what about the notion that President Trump seems now to be running for re-election on, to some degree, that pressure from the racial justice movement is causing the police to pull back from the kinds of proactive enforcement that gets guns off the street because the police are afraid of confrontations begun by the criminals that will wind up getting the cops in trouble? The police unions locally say that too. Real to any degree, in your opinion?
Not at all. It's a nonsensical argument. And the reason why I'm confident in saying that is that we've seen this play out before. When we were challenging the overly aggressive stop and frisk program, the counter argument was if we scale it back, crime will go up and we'll see levels of violence unseen since the crack cocaine epidemic. As you know, Brian, what happened after the federal court declared stop and frisk was practiced by the NYPD unconstitutional, and it was dramatically scaled back. Stop and frisk encounters dropped to levels below 50,000 per year when there was a high of 685,000, and crime didn't go up. It went down dramatically. And so I think the best thing that we can do is to promote a tolerant relationship between the police and the community, where there's a sharing of information. One of the challenges that we face in some inner city communities where you see elevated levels of violence, where a small number of people are doing the greatest degree of harm, is that because there is no trust, there's no cooperation, there's no sharing of information in many instances, then some of the individuals who are engaging in wrongdoing can do so with impunity. And so the aggressive police tactics that target and brutalize folks without justification do far more harm to public safety than good.
The coronavirus relief bill, the House passed a version you call the HEROES Act. Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republicans are starting to come up with their version. Then you'll negotiate to reconcile, I presume. Can you tell us what's most important to you in the House bill and where you see the most difficult points of difference likely to come from the Senate?
The most important thing that we can do is to enact a comprehensive, thorough, and transformative response, which is what the HEROES Act was all about, on May 15th. We have to start with that concept, because if you don't understand that we are in the midst of a pandemic that has been incredibly deadly, more than 140,000 people dead, more than 4 million Americans infected by the coronavirus, over 50 million Americans unemployed, the economy in recession, possibly heading toward depression-like conditions, but Mitch McConnell thinks it's all good, there's no reason to do anything significant. That is the fundamental problem which has brought us to this moment. And that's been led, that idea that everything's fine, it's all going to work out, we're at 15 cases, it'll be down to zero, all of a sudden, like magic, the virus is going to disappear. If you have that kind of mindset, then you fail to act transformatively. And so hopefully We're seeing some indications, based on the most recent cancellation, for instance, of the Make America Hate Again convention that was being planned in Jacksonville, Florida, that the president gets, for political reasons, that he has to now act responsibly and decisively. If that change in approach has occurred, then the data can drive the intervention. And that means that we're going to do things similar to what was done in the HEROES Act, where we have $875 billion set aside for states and localities so that we don't see dramatic cuts to public health, public education, public transportation, public safety, public sanitation, and the public good. We set aside about $185 billion to provide direct assistance to tenants and to homeowners who are struggling to pay their rent and or their mortgages. We authorized an additional round of direct stimulus payments at the same level that was authorized in the CARES Act to every American who makes $75,000 or less who would get $1,200. And we increased the amount of eligibility per child from $500 to $1,200, recognizing that things haven't gotten better, they continue to get worse. And the last thing, Brian, which is probably the most pressing item in terms of deadline and timeline, is extending that $600 per week increase in unemployment insurance that is scheduled to run out on July 31st. The HEROES Act extends that into next year because we recognize that we're still in the midst of a dangerous recession that is hurting the well-being of the American people.
I've seen a small business group in New York City say they're having trouble getting employees to return to work because the $600 enhancement over the usual unemployment benefits is giving many people more income by staying out of work than by working. I've heard one proposal for the new bill that would cap benefits at 70% of the person's income from their jobs. Is that something you could support?
That's not something that I can support because I think this moment requires us to reevaluate how we are going to create prosperity in every single zip code, not just for the wealthy, the well-off, and the well-connected, but in every single zip code. And so there's a difference in approach here. There are some, not saying this is the perspective of the small business group, however, there are some Republican senators who basically believe that everyday Americans should work on poverty wages, and that the problem with the unemployment insurance is that we are trying to provide everyone with a decent ability to live with some degree of integrity and comfort to every American. And that is what the $600 per week increase is designed to accomplish. If wages were higher throughout America, then the $600 per week increase would not be a disincentive to work to the extent that that is even a legitimate argument that is being advanced. And so it seems to me the market should respond at this moment by making sure that everyone can receive a living wage. And I believe that the overwhelming majority of the American people want to work, but they just want to make sure that that basic American contract, when you work hard and play by the rules, it allows you to live and provide a comfortable living for yourself and for your family. That is the American middle class dream, and it has been threatened by an approach where the overwhelming majority of prosperity has been shared by the privileged few, not by the people, and that has to change.
Let's take a phone call. Carol in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Congressman Hakeem Jeffries. Hi, Carol. Right to your point, because
yes,
he's got to go in a minute to go vote. Hi.
Okay, I think Yoho should be censored. I'd heard Ocasio-Cortez's speech. I watched it twice, actually. He also called her dangerous. The other thing I want to add, since there's short time, way back in the day, Jesse Jackson said, educate rather than incarcerate. I think we need to bring that back where there's an emphasis on services. And instead of saying defund the police, find some other kind of phrasing, reframe that. There's a whole lot more I'd like to say, but you said I have short time, so there it is.
So call again, Carol. And Congressman, any reaction to Carol in Manhattan?
Yes, well, thank you, Carol, for laying that out. And, you know, with respect to what Jesse Jackson referred to as the prison industrial complex, you know, a system that was constructed where you basically take the lives of young black and brown individuals, largely males in its initial incarnation in the inner city, and view them as economic commodities as part of the war on drugs, where their incarceration becomes the fuel for the economy in other parts of the country, where factories and plants and manufacturing activity has left and prisons were built up in their place. And so that's a system that we certainly need to deconstruct and disinvest and strike a series of blows against the mass incarceration epidemic, as we began to do in Congress with passage of the bipartisan First Step Act in 2018. But there's much more work that needs to be done. We incarcerate more people in America than any other country in America, in the world. When the failed war on drugs first started in 1971, when Nixon declared drug abuse public enemy number one, we had less than 350,000 people incarcerated in America. Today is 2.2 million, disproportionately black and Latino, a significant number of them nonviolent drug offenders. And so it's a stain on our society. It has destroyed lives, destroyed families, destroyed individuals, destroyed communities, and we need to reverse it with the fierce urgency of now.
Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat from Brooklyn and Queens, we always appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.